This is the RDU On Stage podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on this episode, I'm chatting with Ian Finley. Ian Finley is a professional actor, playwright, NC Piedmont laureate, and educator. As the chair of fine arts at Research Triangle High School, he has seen firsthand the benefits of exposing young people to the arts and how an arts program can enhance science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM curriculums and project-based learning. Finley's mother was a working actress, and although he found himself performing on stage at an early age, it wasn't until high school that he says he truly found his calling, and that is where our conversation begins.
I was not really a theater kid, per se, until the summer between my junior and senior years of high school, and I did University of Utah's Theater School for Youth, and standard theater camp sort of thing. And I remember going the first day and at the end of the first day being so overwhelmed with joy that I had had this experience being with people like me and doing these things, and the idea that I could come back the next day and do that, and that in fact that this was a four-week camp, I couldn't even comprehend that amount of happiness. And of course, it had all the parts of theater in it, right? It was the community part, and there was creation part, and there was the identity part all wrapped together there. And that's when I became a theater person. I told my mom at the end of the camp that I was going into theater, and she was horrified by this. Only time she'd ever really pushed back against something I wanted to do. But I then, my senior year of high school, we had a new drama teacher who was utterly incompetent, and we basically took the program over from her, and I ended up doing seven shows that year between acting and directing different pieces, and really got my hands dirty there. And the next year went into the actor training program at the University of Utah, because my goal then was to be an actor. ATP at the University of Utah is a world-class program. It's so wonderful. But it is a conservatory acting program, and I realized 2 years in that I was, as much as I love theater, acting was not really what I was best at. I felt it was directing and writing at the time. I realize now it's teaching. And I was going to drop out of the program, and the teacher said, this training will serve you well for all those other things. And they were absolutely correct. You know, all the great writers, Molière and Shakespeare, also were actors as well, and so that knowledge informs the other half. So yeah, that's and I went to NYU for grad school, again intending to write plays, which I still do, but along the way I realized that the thing I love most is actually the teaching part of it. I started teaching at 19 at that theater school for youth, which I had gone to 2 years before and had been so transformative. For many years, I pushed against that. You know, there's that horrible, toxic cancer of a saying that those who can do and those who can't teach. And that, you know, was inscribed in the back of my head. And it's, you know, it's right up there, I think, with the Nazi salute as things that exist in the world that cause pain. Because it took me years to get my own pride over that, to realize that teaching was the thing I loved most, and that it allowed me to create theater as well on the way.
So what is it about teaching that is so inspiring to you?
On one hand, you get to create theater. You know, we do a lot of theater at RTHS. We do a play in the fall, a musical review, a musical, a Shakespeare. We do a full season of improv. We do a 48-hour film festival that the brilliant John Wood puts together. So we do a great deal. So if your goal is to get in there and make theater, it's a tremendous crucible in order to do that. But you're making theater with people who actually care about it. You know, I worked professionally in the theater for many years, and oftentimes you have wonderful people, and then you have people who are just there for a paycheck, right? Who don't care and who are very jaded and very cynical, because working professionally in the theater is exhausting and it will make you jaded and cynical. I've certainly been in productions where the director has made me jaded and cynical over the course of the rehearsal process. And you have less of that, I think, in a high school world, because you have students, at least certainly here, who really care, who this is the world to them, and they're willing to bring so much in, and do work. In terms of the work I have directed, I am prouder of the work I've done with students than the work I've done professionally. And I don't mean that sentimentally. I mean my students have done better work in many instances than the work I have done on professional stages as a director.
Well, and I think one thing that might surprise people is that we are sitting in Research Triangle High School. We're not at the School of the Arts. We're not at some magnet school for the arts. We are at Research Triangle High School, which is a charter high school, and you've mentioned you produce all of these shows. How does theater or drama program fit into STEM curriculum?
It works in two directions. The upward direction is that creating theater, really all of the arts, requires a mindset that is entirely consistent with the STEM mindset. That is to say, the fancy term is iterative. That is, we do a thing, we test it, a hypothesis or an experiment, we see what's wrong, we make an adjustment, we test it again, we see what's wrong, we test it again, and we iterate. It's not here and we're done, it's click, 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 click. That's how science works, that's how engineering works, it's how theater works. The process of rehearsal means we come in, we see a thing, that doesn't work, change that, do it again. Change that, do it again. The rehearsal process is an iterative process. The playwriting process, write a draft, that's crap, make these revisions, that's crap, make these revisions, still crap, make these revisions, okay, now we're getting there. 10 drafts in, you have a play that you're ready to go there. The creative process, done what I think properly, is iterative. I believe in revision. I believe in rehearsal. I am violently, any of the teachers here can tell you this, I'm violently against the romantic notion of a muse reaching down and putting an idea in your head. It's a lie. We revise, we practice, and that's where art comes from. It's not a gift from the gods. And that idea of going back to the hypothesis, testing, changing, testing, changing, is the scientific process. So it turns out that, and there is a certain amount of fortitude that's required in that, realizing that this hypothesis is not getting proven in this experiment. It's getting proven 100 experiments in. That requires some guts, some long-term thinking. That same long-term thinking is what leads to really great art. It will not be good in the first rehearsal. It will not be good in the first draft. And so those types of thinking work together. We can engender that in the arts program that then goes on to support the scientific programming. But more, that sense of long-term thinking, of fortitude, of just getting in there and doing the work over and over and over again and taking joy in the repetition of it, that our scientifically minded students here have, also leads them to be incredible artists. The other way it works, so that's sort of how does scientific thinking inform the creation of art. The other way is the other side, and that is we are told by this reductionist sort of media that we have a left brain and a right brain, right? And that these things are in conflict with each other. And either you're left-brained or you're right-brained, either you're analytical or you're creative, and that is another egregious lie. Every great inventor has been both a creative and an analytic. Every genius uses both parts of them. No one who's ever created anything great has depended on one hand or the other. And therefore, the arts, the using of the creative, creative is one of those words that has a bad rap, right? I say creative and you think of someone, you know, getting stoned in wearing a beret, right? Or reading Proust and not understanding it. Creative literally means to create, right? That's what every entrepreneur does. All of these very right-brained people are doing creation if they're successful. They are being creative if we actually go to the origin of the word. And therefore, if you're going to succeed in science and especially technology, engineering, you're going to need to create things. Engineers don't just draft things, they have to create them. I think perhaps it is less necessary for that math portion of that because that is more purely theoretical, but that's where the other one goes, because that idea of attacking a problem and iterating the problem that you get in math comes right back to art. So I feel that in both directions, from the science to the art and from the art to the science, these two things coexist beautifully. And in fact, when you separate them out, they fail. I don't believe in isolated conservatory type education very much. You can have great effect in that, but I believe that the creators of our next generation have to be able to create art, not just do musical theater or just play the oboe or just choreograph. The people I'm seeing in the current market that we have out there have to be able to do all things, which means that they have to be able to create and then analyze. They have to use the left and then the right brains. And if you have an education that focuses on one or the other, you're going to make it harder for them in the market that we have coming up.
Totally agreed. I remember a few years ago, there was some Da Vinci painting found in some basement or something, and these scientists were dissecting it to figure out if it was an actual authentic piece. And I said, great, all of these scientific kids that are coming out of these science schools and math schools with no arts program, they'll be able to figure it out, but they won't know who Da Vinci is.
Both of the things I've said are very true and very important, but of course, they're not the real reason we do the arts. The real reason we do the arts is to give us meaning, to connect us to other human beings. That's very hard to put into a grant proposal, right? But ultimately, that is why the arts exist, is not just to give us skills or to develop parts of our brain, although they do that, but rather to give us a door to the actual meaning of existence. And you can reduct that down to community, right? It trains empathy and gives you a chance to work with people. You can reduce that down to work ethic. You can reduce that down to personal responsibility. But what it really is a sense that there is a purpose in life that you are part of, and that purpose is distilled into the act of theater. And of course, that sounds very airy-fairy, and that's why instead I talk about, you know, the iterative process in the left and the right brain. But underneath that, what's really going on is something that I think is much more holistic.
Why is exposing kids to the arts, even if you have a kid who's not in an arts program, why is taking the kid to the theater important?
So much of what our next generations are is self-focused and typically through the lens of a screen, right? I will make this video and put it out on YouTube. I will do this. It is very eye-focused. As opposed to encountering art, whether that is visual art or musical art or theater, that requires you to take a view of what someone else is doing, to see that and to take it in. And then, of course, my experience whenever I see a great play is, oh, I want to do that play now. Oh, I want to direct that play. Or I want to write a play just like it, because all art is derivative, right? But it starts not with the internal focus, the self center, but rather the external center, putting your focus elsewhere. And that's going to be useful whether you go on to create anything or not. That idea of taking the focus off of the self and viewing something larger and experiencing something larger through that.
Recently, I had a conversation about theater for young audiences with Noah Putterman, who is really amazing, director, actor, just person. And one thing we discussed is that the approach to theater for young audiences in other countries is very different than the approach to theater for young audiences in this country, which is typically more conservative and centered around fairy tales and stories we all already know and safe stories. Do you have any knowledge if the approach to theater or arts education is different in other countries versus the United States?
Yes, and it's the same thing. And that is because the theater in the United States is becoming more and more commercial. And that is because the cost of Broadway shows keeps going up and up and up and up. And producers, very wisely, want to recoup their investments, and so they've done what Hollywood has done for years, and that they only want to do work that has a built-in audience, an existing IP. And so the work becomes more and more and more derivative. Theater for young audiences becomes the same thing. If we're going to put in this money, then we need to make sure we have an audience. If we do something that is daring, we might not have an audience. If we do Little Red Riding Hood, we probably will. And therefore, the market, and I say that sort of as a four-letter word, is working against the creative impulse. Now, you can go too far in the other direction. There are plenty of countries where there is no sort of market for the arts, and sort of everything goes, and we'll give a grant to everybody, and the pendulum can swing too far in that direction as well. You have to be sort of deliberate, and one thing that the market does is it does sort of weed out the less successful pieces, but the market is a dangerous thing when it comes to theater. How that impacts theater education is that, again, the market comes into the classroom to some degree. Students want to do shows that they have seen movies of. They are told because of American Idol and the Tonys that theater is a competition. And much of theater education in this country bends in that direction because that's what the students are saying, and it is a lie. It is an egregious lie. The arts are not a competition. It is not a zero-sum game. If this theater company does an incredible production, that does not make this other theater company less likely to do an incredible production. It actually makes them more likely to do it because theater company A has raised the bar for what audiences and other creators are doing in that community. It is not, they're doing well, you know, they won this award, that means they're better than us and we're not doing, and we have to hate them. No, the theater arts can and should support each other rather than saying, oh, we need to be better than them. It is not a competition. It's what I call football thinking. Football is a competition, and one school goes against another school, and that school gets a trophy and the other school doesn't, and that can be useful, but the arts are not that. The arts are not a sport, and yet that sort of market pressure that, you know, we've got to be the best, we've got to beat them at regionals, you know, from Glee, if you think about that, has really pushed educational theater in many instances to become more and more commercial as theater has become more and more commercial, more competitive. Now, it doesn't have to be that way, and there are so many incredible theater educators in the Triangle area, and I'm sure this is true across the country, who are pushing back against that and saying, you know what? We don't need to spend $20,000 on sets as long as what we do has integrity to the script and the audience. We don't need to be better than this other one as long as we are doing the best thing that we can. There are incredible theater educators who are pushing back against those market forces, I think, opening the door. I'm sorry, you asked me a question that got me up on my soapbox, so apologize for that.
Well, and I guess what I hear you saying is that so much of theater is focused on the finished product, ignoring the process.
Yes. And again, I can probably think of more examples where that's not the case. That more teachers who are doing work that really is process focused and opening up to tremendous explorations of devised theater and, Meisner realism and these very non-commercial pieces. But I do think that generally the trend, the societal trend, pushes us more and more toward, just as with on Broadway, filling the seats, giving them a spectacle, selling the tickets, because of course producing high school theater is producing theater, which means it's a budget game. The most valuable thing I learned at Baring Cole Theater Company was how to make a proper spreadsheet that had all the calculations and the cells tied together. The budgets for the shows we do here, it's about $30,000 or $40,000 each year to do high school theater that seats 100 people per show. There are theaters, high school theaters, that the budgets are 10 times that, and I can see how when you're doing that, it becomes a push to do the bigger shows, and many students, again, bowing to what they're told on television, want to do those bigger shows. And they're not wrong to want to do that. That's what they've been pushed toward. So I think there is that push toward the big, shiny product, the spectacle element that Aristotle talks about rather than the other elements. But there are so many great teachers who are pushing in the other direction for pieces that explore, pieces that fail, pieces that, as we're working towards something, Bill Ball uses the phrase the measure of success. The measure of success will not be, did we sell out every night? The measure of success will not be that we made a certain budget, but did we explore the realism of this scene? Or did we find a way to get a laugh in an honest way? That there are multiple measures of success for any given production.
I do want to talk a little bit about the Alien controversy, yeah. Because, you know, theater programs across the country kind of got the spotlight because that one, you know, high school production in New Jersey really made news. And on the one hand, people celebrated the students and were excited about the creativity they showed. On the other hand, the teachers were vilified for allowing the students to produce something that was copyright infringement, you know, based on a big movie franchise that was quite popular. I'm on the fence. I appreciate the creativity that goes into any kind of, you know, high school theater or art production. I love that. And as a journalist, I'm also very mindful about copyright infringement as a writer. So where do you stand on that? And as an educator, what responsibility does a theater educator or arts educator, for that matter, have in guiding students to understand the legalities of what they're doing?
Absolutely. So there's an improv game called Good News, Bad News, where someone will say, you know, the good news is this, and then someone will take that and say, but the bad news is this, and then they'll say, but the good news is this, and we'll go back and forth. This thing is like one of those. So the bad news is a high school theater group said, we want to take the movie Alien and do it on stage. Crazy idea. Also an illegal idea, because that is very much copyright. And they did not get the approvals to do that, which would not have been given initially. Copyright just is not, for film, is not given out because it's film. It's not published. It's not available anywhere. So they broke the law. That's the bad news. The good news is it spurred them on to do something that was really remarkable. You know, the spectacle of it, the stagecraft of it.
The recycled, you know, they use recycled materials to build their props and their costumes.
Exactly, and a minuscule budget to do things that were tremendous, largely student designed and driven. So that's the good news. The bad news, again, on the other side, is that it then, you know, word got out that they had broken the law, and I will come back to that, but that's what they did. You know, there's no way around it. There is a very clear law, and they broke it. Good news is Ridley Scott came and said, you know, this is great, and I will use my power over the copyright, because I own it, to say, yes, they should do that. So ultimately, a good story, a good opportunity for students to learn, and yet they did break the law. And so the question is, well, how valuable is that law then in comparison to all the good things these students got out of it? And the reason why that law is important is because those high school students who figured out how to do these things are going to go on to create things later on in their life. And the only way they will get paid is because of copyright. We've talked about the market, and I think you can get a sense that I don't think the market is particularly useful when it comes to creating art. And it's particularly true here. Without the protections guaranteed by copyright, creators, specifically writers, cannot make a living, and therefore they go into other fields, and therefore our written work, our entire canon, is degraded because there's no way to ensure that when you write something, you're going to get paid for it. Copyright did not always exist. Shakespeare's time, they didn't have copyright. And so I think it's the fourth quarto of Hamlet. We think someone just snuck in with and took notes, and that's why you have the speech beginning, to be or not to be, that's the point. Because they wrote it down wrong. And eventually we developed copyright to make sure that writers could get paid for what they do. And they don't get paid much. It is typically 7%. That's good news. 7% of the gross box office is what the writer gets for something. And therefore, if those brilliant kids who made the Alien production want to go on to have an actual life a career doing these things, then those mechanisms of copyright have to be protected for their own good. And so I think it's the short term versus the long term question, right? In the short term, yes, it's good these kids were able to do this. But as I try to teach my students who say, well, what matters if I cheat on this? What matters if I come to school late? You always have to look at an ethical question of what if everyone did that? And if everyone did that, then the structures of copyright that then ensure that they would have a career in the future are undermined. So from an ethical point of view, what they did was wrong. I'm glad that Ridley Scott was able to give them that permission. And there's, luckily, in this case, there's a simple way around it. And that is, the canon of dramatic literature is enormous. There are so many plays out there. And what happened with, you know, they clearly worked their butts off to make the Alien production, but they made one lazy choice. And that is choosing a movie to turn into a play instead of looking at the enormous number of plays out there that they could have done and done just as amazingly and done legally. So there is a lack of dramatic stuff. And you can always create your own. That's always a possibility. But I think people often go to creating their own rather quickly instead of looking at the literally thousands of plays that are available in the existing canon.
So as a teacher, do you think this event, this Alien production, provides a teachable moment for other teachers? Or do you think it's going to open the door for other high schools to do productions that are not, that are against the law?
Yeah, they're doing it anyway. You know, there are so many high schools. And what happens, I'm about to sound very cynical, and I apologize for that. What happens is that students say, I want to do this movie, because they've seen the movie. And they either, make the teacher do that, or perhaps as my senior year in high school, the teacher doesn't really have much influence over the students. And so the students, because they don't know the wider canon of what you can do and are more familiar with movies, take a movie and they try to put it on stage. And movies don't belong on stage. Plays don't belong on screen. They are two different, equally viable works of art. I say that, I'm working right now on adapting one of my plays for the screen, but if you're going to do that, it must be because the medium brings something to it. The producers worked on stage. It was a movie about theater, so it makes sense for it to live in the theater. Young Frankenstein doesn't belong on stage. There's nothing theatrical about it. There's nothing that the medium brings to the message. And therefore, you know, the reason why these movies are being done on high school stages is because it's what people are familiar with. It's a bit of people not quite doing their homework and looking at the thousands of plays by authors, known and less well-known, that are out there that can serve their purposes just as well.
It sounds like what you're saying is the teacher bears some culpability in this, in helping steer the students towards work that could be similar in content or similar in themes, but that is within the canon of...
Exactly. A high school teacher's main job, I think, is to read plays, to know what's come before and what comes after. So when a student says, I want to do this, the teacher can say, well, you could do this play or this play or this play. We could do a scene from this. And to open up their minds to the enormous canon that is out there. There is, this is a poor illustration, but my incredible acting teacher and voice teacher from the University of Utah, Sarah Shippett Botham, back in undergrad, gave me a list of 100 plays that everyone should know. And I read that list, and coming out of high school, I knew two of them. I knew Glass Menagerie, and I knew Night Mother. And I realized I was coming from behind. So one of my big goals is to make sure that when my students leave here, they know the plays on there. They know, sure, Shakespeare and Our Town and Tennessee Williams, but they also know Beckett. They also know Ionesco. They know Carol Churchill. They know Wolsoinka. They know that whatever they want to do, they absolutely can create their own plays in a variety of different styles. Mm-hmm. But they can also draw on an existing body of work out there that is so much wider than Hollywood would have them believe.
I feel that theater and art is such a transformative experience for so many young people. Do you have any examples in all the years you've been working of a student or a young person that you've seen be completely transformed or changed because of their exposure to?
Every single year, without exception, there are multiple students who leave this school a happier, more successful person because of the arts. And there are different reasons for that. Think of a young man graduated, not this last year, but the year before that, who had entered in as very quiet, very sort of painfully shy person, and who through theater and through improv primarily, discovered a tremendous voice for himself, a tremendous confidence in himself, and left through that. Another, again, tremendously shy young man, had tremendous difficulty expressing himself verbally, but one of the most gifted musicians I've ever known in my life, and through composing for theater found, again, that sense of self-confidence, that sense of community. I mean, these very practical things, but I think more than that, a sense of being able to contribute in a way that is authentic. We use the idea of project-based learning at this school, that what you're doing in class is not just worksheets or, some nonsensical thing, but at least the idea, and it works better in some classrooms than others, but what you're doing is actually real, that there are consequences for that. The theater classroom is one of the few places where that project-based model is true. It's not just we're saying, we're going to, present this to judges, or this is at least superficially real. It's very real. It's if you are in my tech theater classes and you fail building a platform and that platform collapses and someone gets a concussion, then it's a reality. And I think for many of my students, it's the first time that the work that they have done has been necessary, and when they receive praise for it, it's authentic. It's not just, you did well, here's a pat on the head, but you did something that mattered to other people beyond themselves in that larger window, on top of that, again, that sense of self-confidence, that sense of community. Every year it comes through, and that's one of the great joys of being a teacher.
And that's not to say, and I think it's important for parents who have a kid who says, I want to be in my high school theater class, or want to take this as an elective, or I want to join drama club. That's not to say that exposing kids to the arts means that they are going to pursue a career in the arts.
No. And in fact, that's it's quite the opposite. I always feel a little bit badly when I have students who say, I want to pursue this professionally, because I know it's tremendously hard, and there are other ways to be happy career-wise than necessarily life in the arts. However, experience with the arts, living in the arts rather than a career in the arts, is going to enrich whatever choice that these students make.
Finley is producing the upcoming production of Little Shop of Horrors at Research Triangle High School. The show opens this week and runs through March 1st. I'll put a link to the school's website and ticket page in the episode notes. If you like what you've heard today, please consider subscribing to the podcast. Follow us on social media at RDU on Stage. Become a patron of this program, or visit us online at www.rduonstage.com. Until next week, I'll see you at the theater.